KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a visitor at the Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy and associate professor at Elon University School of Law and an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Today I'm very excited and thrilled to have on my friend Frank Pasquale, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, author of the forthcoming book, The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms Behind Money and Information. So Frank was on the show several years ago talking about some of this work. We spent time talking about the regulation of search engines and what informational needs are needed by consumers of technology and consumers of information on the Internet. Pardon me. In this upcoming book, which comes out and will be available November 17th of 2014, Frank focuses on a variety of ways that information is kept secret through corporate mechanisms, through law, through regulation, and even through opacity and privacy that prevents the public from knowing what a range of industries are doing, and also even prevents regulators from having a good sense of how they should regulate this activity and write law. It's a massive issue, which, of course, has been a focus of mine. It's been a focus on Hearsay Culture. We've had guests really going from the beginning of the show that have talked about information systems and information structure. But up until now, we've not had a book that brought together a sector-by-sector analysis, and three or four primary sectors, in fact, analysis of what that secrecy is about, what information isn't available, and what its ramifications are. On top of diagnosing the problem, Frank also offers some solutions that we'll talk about as well, but the range of the book is quite extraordinary. For anyone that reads Frank's blogging in a variety of websites, you'll know that Frank is a master at both annotation and citation. If you're looking for sources of work and sources of research, you can regularly turn the things that Frank has written about, and his ability to hyperlink is truly one of legend. I say that as a deep compliment as an academic, and this book is no exception. Frank's understanding of the literature that exists around these different industries and a citation to them, I think, alone serves as a research source for a variety of other areas, not just about secrecy, not just about these industries, but broadly about information policy, about privacy, about regulatory activity, the role of regulators, and indeed what we mean by the Internet today. But we take a deep dive in the book, and Frank will take a deep dive in the book, in areas like those algorithms behind money and information. How is it that credit scores are calculated, and what does it mean for consumers when consumers are unable to access information that leads to their credit score? If they want to audit what that score is, how do they deal with the reality that they can't actually figure out how the score came up in the first place? When we're dealing with a variety of investment instruments, how do we understand how to regulate those instruments in light of the financial collapse over the last several years if we don't know how those decisions are made and who's making them? So there's a lot of issues here in the Black Box Society that Frank touches on, and we are going to, of course, even in the hour that we have, only touch on a tip of some of those issues, and we'll go through them with at least enough time to be able to get a sense of the book. The way that Frank frames these issues is interesting because he talks about the incongruity between information flows and human beings today, and poses a number of questions in the introduction of the book that I think are useful. In fact, if I were looking for a script for this interview, I could simply just read these questions to him and ask him to answer the questions that he's posed to himself in the book. But I'm going to read them anyway because they're useful for framing our discussion. Frank asks some questions like, how has secrecy become so important to industries ranging from healthcare to defense, from Wall Street to Silicon Valley? What are the social implications, he asks, of the invisible practices that hide the way people and businesses are labeled and treated? How can the law be used to enact the best possible balance between privacy and openness? And he points out, which is where we'll start off, the answer to these questions is to chart a path towards a more intelligible social order. So Frank's work is really quite stunning. Again, it'll be available November 17th. By way of background, for those that aren't familiar with Frank, he, again, is a professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law. He focuses both on health and information law issues. He's a member of the NSF-funded Council for Big Data, Ethics, and Society. He's been an affiliate fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project and also at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy, where I am currently affiliated. He's been a visiting professor at Yale and also Cardozo Law School. He was a Marshall Scholar at Oxford University. He's a prolific writer, author, scholar, all around, you know, wonderful person and scholar. And so I'm going to stop fawning there and simply say, Frank, you're joining us today, the day after the election, November 4th, 2014, via Skype from your office at the University of Maryland. Thank you much for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, well, thank you, Dave. It is so great to have such a kind introduction, and I'm a huge fan of the show and really happy to be back.
Well, thank you. So, Frank, let's start off. You've been on the show before. Many of my listeners will be familiar with you, but I think it's useful because of the structure of the book. Why don't you talk a bit more about your background and why you decided now was the time to put out a book about it, and we'll talk about the Black Box Society.
Sure. You know, I've been thinking about internet law since about 2004, 2005. And at that time, and you'll remember this time too, there was just such enormous enthusiasm about what was going on online. And a lot of us, there was still the novelty of going onto Google and being able to find almost any reference that you wanted to find. And, you know, social networks were just burgeoning then, you know, like MySpace and then growing into things like Facebook nowadays. And that was a world in which a lot of law professors and those in internet policy were trying to figure out their problem that they set for themselves was essentially, how do you get old forms of law to get out of the way of these incredibly innovative companies in Silicon Valley? Well, I was enthused about that, and I've written a couple articles in that vein myself regarding copyrights and some other IP issues. But I also, as I started looking more into this world, I came across more and more stories of people who felt like they were getting the short end of the stick. And I was worried about some early court cases where, say, a company would be disappeared off of Google, even if people were searching for it. Like a company, the company name Kinderstart is one of them. And there are some other firms like this, Foundum, which I describe in my book. And these companies would sue, and courts would respond, hey, wait a second. You know, you can't sue because Google is like a newspaper and it can order the results any way it wants. And my big worry out of that First Amendment absolutism was that I felt like if those sorts of cases became dominant and really shaped the legal landscape over the next 10 years, that could set us on a path where essentially we would not be able to exercise any control over a lot of very important utilities for finding information. Now, the other side of the book, the other side from the internet law side, is a finance side. And there's very few people in the internet policy space that think very much about finance. And I think part of that is a commendable specialization. There's just so much going on. People really want to specialize and understand one corner of it well. But what I found was that a lot of the abuses I was seeing were essentially driven by business models that involved speed, scale, and speculation. It was becoming as big as possible as a firm, getting massive scale as quickly as possible in order to satisfy the demands of speculative capital. And I felt that this, as an ultimate rationale for what was going on online in many contexts, needed to be exposed and explained. Now, I've just described the subject matter of the book and how it arose out of my scholarship and my inquiry. The theory of the book essentially grew out of my experience as a researcher continually running into sort of walls where in order to answer a certain question that was really important, I would run into the wall of trade secrecy or legally compelled secrecy or just extreme complexity. You know, documents that are thousands and thousands of pages that are really very difficult to parse, both on the side of internet companies and on the side of finance. And what I try to do in the book is I try to point out where that secrecy is remediable and where that complexity is remediable, where things could be made more intelligible. So that was sort of the intellectual journey that led to the Black Box Society as a book.
Now, the phrase black box is one that, of course, you haven't invented, but it's one that is useful here. So for listeners that aren't familiar with that idea, define for us, for purposes of your book, what the black box is. What are its parameters and its properties?
Sure. It is used, first of all, in an engineering context. So if engineers are diagramming, say, a large system, they may have one part of the system where inputs go in and outputs come out, but we don't know what happened in between. And they will diagram that for convenience sake as a black box. They'll say, we just don't know what's going on in the black box. It gets used colloquially, even in contexts like the jury. You know, like we may not know ever what went on in a jury's mind when it decides guilty or not guilty. There's no real recording of that. We might hear from people that were in the jury, but who really knows who's reliable and who's not, et cetera. That's a black box process as well. So it refers to sort of ideally to technical environments in the engineering context, but also can be applied in many other areas. But there's a second meaning of black box where it conveys surveillance, particularly, say, in a plane that crashes. So if you have a plane that goes down, the first thing we hear about is, well, how do we find the black box? And originally these black boxes were things that were recording what was going on, say, in the cockpit, recording what the pilots were saying and other things. As planes have become more automated, now it will keep track of 30,000 different data points, at least, within the plane. And this surveillance not only is in planes, it's now, I believe, been ordered by the Department of Transportation for cars. The cars are going to have these black boxes to improve safety and to improve the monitoring of their systems. One of the reasons why I try to bring these two meanings together and why they become the title of the book is because I feel like each of us is becoming more like the plane or the car. We as people are being monitored in many different areas, but what happens to that data is like the black box of the engineer. We have no idea. So there are these, you know, each of us has thousands of scores that are kept on us, scores about, say, from ranging from credit scores, which we kind of know about those, to the credit scores we know about, but then there's lots of credit scores we don't know about, to frailty scores, reliability scores, fraud scores, all these sort of ways in which we're being ranked and rated and scored and evaluated. And the data for that scoring comes from systems in society that monitor us as closely as the systems monitor, say, a car or a plane. But then when it's processed, then that's a trade secret of the companies doing the processing. So that's where I think the black box idea, it's double-edged, and I think it's very powerful to describe the kind of society we're living in right now.
We're chatting with Professor Frank Pasquale of University of Maryland School of Law, author of the forthcoming book, The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms Behind Money and Information, on KCSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Frank, there's a lot of terminology in the book. I think it adds to a useful and deep understanding of these issues. I want to ask you about a few because I think they frame not only the questions I'm going to ask, but they frame the book. You refer to broadly the knowledge problem. And what is, if you can summarize it, the knowledge problem that we will then dig into by some examples and through your thesis?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked about that, Dave, because that is another big motivation for writing the book. And this comes out of a debate between the libertarian Friedrich von Hayek and a lot of Cambridge economists, other economists in England in the 40s and 50s. And it was an economic debate, though, that still rings true to our time, or it's important in our time. And essentially what a lot of economists, particularly maybe fans of Keynes or those who are fans of even socialist economic thought, they said at the time, you know, we need the government to plan a lot more about our economy. And you saw that out of the New Deal, right? I mean, after the New Deal, after the collapse in the Great Crash of 29 and the Great Depression, a lot of people said, wait a second, we let the market run too much and the government has to start running certain things to make sure that it doesn't all fall apart. Well, people like Hayek responded, particularly in the 1945 article, The Use of Knowledge in Society, and said there is a fundamental flaw with government control over the economy and even a lot of government influence over the economy, which is that people don't know, the governors, the rulers don't know all that's going on in the economy. No person can aggregate the value or understand what's going on in every single little part of the economy. And, you know, that was a valuable insight at the time. But what it eventually has been turned into since over the next 60, 70 years, it's metastasized into this sort of all-purpose rationale for non-intervention by the government, on the basis that people can't understand what's going on, the regulators can't understand what's going on. And someone as, you know, notable as Alan Greenspan essentially adverted to, evoked it by saying, you know, there is irreducible opacity. There's, it's the financial markets are irredeemably opaque. At one point he said that. And the problem, though, is that, of course, they're going to be opaque if you're not even trying to monitor them, right? Or if you're not setting up laws that allow you to look at the books effectively or require data reporting that is standardized. And that's the big problem that I was also sort of fighting against in this book, is that I found that many of the times when people would say, you know, why do you want to even try to regulate something like Google or Goldman Sachs? Because no one can understand what's going on in the rankings in Google. No one can understand these complicated financial instruments. And what I try to point out in the book is that we may well not understand what's going on, but that's not a function of our ignorance or of irredeemable opacity or reducible complexity. It's a function largely of law. It's a function of laws that prevent even regulators from looking at very important aspects of the business practices of these firms.
And I think that gets us, Frank, to if there is a thesis, and I mean that in a loose way, because there is a core understanding and point that you're making through these stories. But is that your thesis, what you just alluded to, that there is a way to understand information assuming that information is shared, or is that making it too simple a point?
That's a really important thesis of the book. I would say the book has three purposes, and I think that they can be folded into theses as well. And the first purpose is to diagnose this problem and to say that a lot of people that are have not really grappled with the fact that law is so powerful in limiting information and limiting information flows. There's so much emphasis on openness, and we all have all this new data and information, but there's not enough people focusing on where exactly is the information closed off. And again, you know, to use the Google example, you know, you may be able to search for all sorts of things online for Google. Try searching how exactly those rankings are done. That's where you run into the wall of opacity. But that's one thesis. The second thesis is one that it proposes reforms from within our existing legal tradition and our existing laws. And the third, that thesis says that it's not sort of a thesis about the nature of knowledge in society. It's more a thesis about we could change things and we could make things a bit better. And then there's a third purpose of the book, which is to say that we may need a much broader vision of social change in order to really get at the root of some of the problems caused by these big companies, be they monopolization, be they sort of mysterious rankings and ratings of culture, be they sort of excess profit-taking by people who, say, are just riding atop the data or money or other things like that. So I think that those are sort of three things that sort of fit together as three purposes of the book. But you're absolutely right to say that that one key thesis is that much of the lack of knowledge we have about the social world could be remedied if we had better laws and better rules.
You know, again, you know, I don't want to turn to a political discussion here, although there are political ramifications for what we're speaking about. But, you know, as we record this on November 4th, 2014, right, the Democratic Party has been routed in midterm elections. And a lot of even our understanding of why the votes went that way, not to mention the policies and policy positions that underlie the votes, we don't understand very well. You go to the pundits today and then you see them attempting to work through data. And it's clear that there are inklings of how you might say, well, you know, this candidate from the Republican Party won this county in Kansas in 2012, but 2014 doesn't. And you can see the kernels of insight that are then blocked or obfuscated, to use the language you use in the book, because we don't have the resources and the ability to aggregate all of that, which is where I think the big data point comes up. You know, I want to ask you, Frank, moving away from theory into some stories now, and I want to frame this question. I'm going to ask you to share a few examples of the problem as you see it. But you define three strategies for secrecy, and I think it might be helpful to describe those and then maybe offer an example of each. You talk about the three strategies being what you call real secrecy, legal secrecy, and you've just referred to it, obfuscation, or, and here's another fun phrase that you use, remediable incomprehensibility. Which is terrific, and I'll probably have to work that in to my discussions with my two young sons when they explain why they ran into walls pretty soon. But be it as it may, can you give us a definition of each and maybe a short example of each, starting with real secrecy?
Absolutely, and I And, you know, given your insights on the election, I'm going to connect each of these to the ways in which they may well have affected the election that we just experienced.
Terrific.
So in terms of real secrecy, that's when, say, somebody has a big vault and they, say, have a lock on it, a padlock, and, say, a 25-character password and encryption, and they try every which way to guarantee that no one can get into that data. And I feel in terms of real secrecy, we might think about that particularly affecting, say, stores of data about people where we don't know what that data is. So, you know, we may well have, there may be lists of us, lists of, say, people who are diabetic, lists of people who have cancer, lists of people who care a lot about Medicare Part C, to come closer to the political context. And those lists are protected often by real secrecy, and that is protection enough to keep us from getting at them. Now, legal secrecy refers to things like trade secrecy, where essentially someone may know what's going on with the processing of the list. So, for example, you know, if I were a political candidate nowadays, or if you're advising political candidates nowadays, you're probably going to tell them that they've got to tell a different story to different types of voters. So a candidate, for example, if they are really sophisticated, they will have a database that will allow them to micro-target ads. And they may have an algorithm where they put together, say, hundreds of data points about a voter, find the most important ones where they can make an appeal, and let's say they find out that they're appealing to a 40-year-old man who lives in downtown, and that maybe they'll show that person an ad for light rail or public transit because they say, oh, that person's going to be a public transit voter. And then they see they have another bit of data that shows that another voter is, say, a 60-year-old woman who has a large car, and they will show that person an ad on their computer or even now, perhaps even on cable networks, targeting to that level for roads that they want to build. Now, those processes of how you have the better algorithm for combining the data to micro-target the advertising, those are largely protected by legal secrecy. I mean, you have people that know about them, but they are under contract or they're under sort of common law restrictions on whether they can share it. Now, with obfuscation, that is a category where essentially neither of the other two things are critical, but what's critical is just creating a lot of unnecessary noise to dampen or to hide the signal. And there in the election context, a great example would be the use of dark money and the use of business entities to hide the ultimate donor of dark money. So you may know that during the fight over the Affordable Care Act, the insurers were talking to the Obama administration, private health insurers, and were, you know, broadly neutral, maybe slightly positive about the Affordable Care Act because they said to the administration, you know, we know that we're going to get new insured people under this act. Well, it turns out that only after the election we found out that they had given over $100 million to the Chamber of Commerce to secretly attack these things. And there was actually just a recent story in the news about a guy named Berman, I believe, who actually was taped, again, secretly taped, and sometimes this gets into spy versus spy territory, but he was taped telling big energy donors that essentially they would be able to run their money through nonprofit organizations so that no one would really know who was running the smear campaigns against people that they wanted to get attacked. Mm-hmm. For example, I think there were celebrities that they wanted to attack who they felt were not really environmentalists. Like they would say, this celebrity says they're environmentalists, but in fact they're riding in a jet plane everywhere or a private plane everywhere. And this is an example of obfuscation because in some of these settings, like maybe they're just slow to report it, some of the more sophisticated ones might create a whole bunch of shell companies. So they have one company giving to another company, giving to another company, and they have people who are directors of the companies, but you may not know exactly what the ties are between the directors and the donors. So there are all these ways in which obfuscation can happen, and that's, I dig into that in the financial context, and in later work in the tax context and in stock trading context, because that it becomes a tool for only the insiders to really know what's going on. Outsiders are left, like I may, if I'm trying to find out who donated to a given campaign, I may have to look up, all right, here's one 501c3 who gave, but it's controlled by another entity that's controlled by another entity. I should have said 501c4. I mean, it's, you know, and again, you can sense just by virtue of that tax law being so complicated and by the corporate structures being so complicated. So that's a really important tool, and it sounds kind of simple, or it sounds kind of just like a like a game on some level. But when you really try to dig into what's happening in complex corporate structures where three companies may own another company that owns another company that owns another company, it's hard to figure out what's going on. And there are whole, giant apartment complexes where we may not know who any of the owners of or any of the apartments are in them, in London in particular, just because a lot of the people who have lots of money like to hide where exactly they're investing or putting those funds.
We're chatting with Professor Frank Pasquale on KZSFM Stanford, Hearsay Culture, author of the forthcoming book, The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms Behind Money and Information. You know, before we take a very short break for PSA, Frank, you know, as you were talking about that, I was reminded, and I think I can say this without revealing any confidences, but, prior to being a law professor, I practiced law in New York, and I remember working on a case in the wake of the Enron meltdown, which now, of course, seems almost quaint in terms of what's happened since, but there was an entity that the firm with which I was for whom I was working represented. There was a venture capital operation, and they had lost quite a bit of money as a result of Enron. And they basically, long story short, I was going through their materials to figure out where, in fact, the losses were. And I'm not an expert in finance, but I became an expert in these instruments that Enron famously put together. Interestingly to me, and I'm curious to get a reaction to it as we transition into some of the more meta points about law and the role of law and the role of the public and the private. When I went to this entity and I said, okay, well, why don't you give me a primer on these instruments based upon your understanding of it? What I found quickly is that they didn't understand it either, even though they had put money into it, and they would show flip charts and things like that. And it led me. I mean, it was a pretty shocking. Obviously, on a personal level, but what started occurring to me, and I'm curious to get a reaction to it, is that even if information is presented, regardless of the mechanism through which the information has not been made public, right, and using the three ways that you've defined it, right, on once that information's out there, that doesn't necessarily answer the question. In order to have the kind of information structure that you seek in the book, it seems to me that other information that is publicly available, right, has to be engrafted into it before we start getting to some of the solutions that we're going to talk about. So my question really for you is this, and it's kind of a pushback question we can then dig into, right? Assuming that information becomes more available, right, what would be the next challenge that we'd have to deal with, right, which is a good way, I think, to backtrack into some of the meta points, right? The information's out there, right? There was Enron, to be clear, right, wasn't hiding anything from this client, right? Here's what we're doing, and the response was, what is that, right? The old Bill Cosby line, right, involving Noah, right? Build an ark this cubit by this cubit, and Noah, right, in Bill Cosby's famous repartee, says, great, what's a cubit?
Sure. You know, and I do appreciate your bringing up the Enron example. I love that example. Yeah. And I think, I guess I would respond on two levels. One would be, sure, there are aspects of, say, the financial crisis, and there are aspects of, say, within internet law where we may well understand the broad outlines, and we may well be able to get access to, say, the reporting. But on the other hand, I mean, I do cite sources in the book who characterize, say, bank accounting as a blank box, as a black box, as just, it's just so hard to get at it. And I think that the Enron example can cut my way on some level, because I recall, at least, now, of course, I wasn't working in the litigation, you know, and you saw corners of litigation between, say, entities that were pretty sophisticated, but at least in the financial press, I recall stories in 2000, 2001, where people started wondering, well, how exactly are these structures set up that Enron is using, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The problem, though, which I think does support your point about, hey, just getting the information isn't enough, is that we did have all this legislation like Sarbanes-Oxley, other reforms, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, peekaboo, that were supposed to make things clearer and did make some things clearer. And yet we still have some real problems in terms of understanding the real risk for some of the largest firms in the economy. And that's where I do turn in the book toward a more substantive look at things. And I turn back the clock to the 1930s when you had, say, Franklin Roosevelt was thinking about how to deal with the Great Depression. And some of his advisors said, what you really need to do is you need to make sure that people are investing, that big companies are investing funds in things that are actually productive. You know, and there were very powerful advisors that were saying, maybe instead of having, and there was even housing bubbles back then, and, you know, rank speculation and on bad Florida real estate at that time. And they said, maybe the answer to the Great Depression is to make sure that things like that don't happen and the investment is made more substantively. But the people that won were following an older tradition, going back to Brandeis at least, that said, no, what we need for investment law is just to make things more transparent. Disclosure is the key. And that was the whole focus of the SEC Act of 1934 and other legislation. And even later legislation like the CFTC, you know, getting created, other things like that. And so I, in the book, in the last chapters, look at that other path that we didn't take in the 30s. I look at the more substantive approach that would essentially govern things. And to give one really concrete example that's been in the news in antitrust here, you know, some people say, and I think the current Federal Trade Commission American policy approach to, say, the dominance of a big company like Google or Facebook or Apple or Amazon, others, is that they should be more transparent about exactly how they are arranging things or ordering things, and that consumers can make more informed choices once they're more transparent. I think we should look into more of a European approach where they are more than willing to actually change the arrangement of information on the screen. So, for example, with Google, to force Google, if someone looks for the weather for the day, to force Google to give three sites that will present the weather differently than, say, the Google weather site or something like that. And I think that's something that we have to turn to. I think similarly with finance, I think we have to just move beyond the disclosure paradigm, because it becomes, particularly in the case of high-frequency trading, it becomes a game of trying to figure out who's disclosing what and sort of manipulating others' perceptions of your perception about what they will do. You know, that's where we're headed in many in disclosure-based regimes that are short-termist, as our finance ones are. And I think that, you know, more of a willingness to think about the substance of what these industries look like, rather than just focusing on, well, are they disclosing enough, is going to be the key to making ours a more intelligible and more humane economy.
We're chatting with Professor Frank Pasquale, author of the forthcoming book, The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms Behind Money and Information, coming from Harvard University Press. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that it is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email us at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. It isn't a black box in that sense. I can tell you that the money will go directly towards things like making sure that the board is working and that we have wiring and that the electricity is paid for and stuff like that. So I am trying to be certainly less secretive and certainly trying to not be in a situation where we have that remediable incomprehensibility. So as clear as possible here. But we do welcome your donations. All right, Frank. So There's a lot here. I want to kind of dive into a couple of points as we get a little more detailed here. We focus heavily on hearsay culture, on law. It's certainly not the only focus, but I want to touch on the legal regime here. Particularly now, where there is, you know, an increasing focus on transparency, and you have the concept of radical transparency that's also gotten currency, the notion of just putting everything out there and letting the chips fall where they may, which in litigation, you know, we'd call a document dump, which actually, as you alluded to, would actually hide information, and put a lot of noise on the table. You talk about the relationship between privacy, which has gotten a tremendous amount of attention, trade secrecy, which is starting to get a little more attention, but which has not, and freedom of information law, which is kind of, you know, sometimes is talked about, sometimes isn't, and falls in the world of administrative law. You know, I have put them under the broad area of what is starting to be known as secrecy studies. But I'm curious to get how you'd characterize this law? And I don't mean it from a semantic sense necessarily of what body of law would you put it in, but how would you describe the relationship between these three concepts that make up one of the three ways of secrecy that you refer to?
You know, I think that in the context of classifying law, I think that's a terrific question, because we've seen this within, as intellectual property scholars and people that talk a lot about the law of intellectual property, we've seen this evolution, I'd say, over the past decade, where it used to be that there'd be just one big intellectual property conference, maybe two, and you'd have people that do copyright, trademark, trade secrecy, patents, all come together and think about the law together. And then there'd be a parallel track of, say, privacy law, and then you'd have things going on, say, in a broader, like, cyber context or cyber law, and maybe these three things going on, cyber law, privacy, intellectual property. And what I found is that a lot of the people doing the most interesting work started combining these things. So you had, say, Julie Cohen started looking at, say, companies, in order to enforce their copyrights, were demanding more intensive surveillance of their users. Okay, so you have a merger of essentially privacy and copyright concerns, the ultimate values that animated each part of law, when you look at how copyright was actually being enforced. And I think that we're going to see more and more stories like that, where essentially, they say, scholars of contract are going to have to really engage with people who are doing trade secrecy, because vice versa. Because we're really going to have to understand when is this a trade secret, have to be sort of protected via contractual mechanisms where people agree not to speak about it explicitly, and where can it just sort of exist as, say, a form of quasi-property or something like that. And I believe that with these three forms of secrecy, as you look at obfuscation in particular, when you have companies that are obfuscating as much as the companies that I describe in the book are, you're going to see consumer protection is going to be one pushback, but there's also going to be other pushbacks that might even come out of innovation law to create public alternatives to them, right? So one solution to a company that is obfuscating or that is doing bad things, like, say, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is publishing all this information about credit card companies that are cheating or that are being reported to have cheated their customers. Well, you can say, you know, let's continue down to that disclosure path and try to make sure that there are rankings and ratings of those companies on their board, and try to get a better and better picture of the power asymmetry involved between the massive credit card companies and consumers. But a whole other perspective is coming out of people that are saying, A, let's encourage innovation and say things that are, if not Bitcoin, then alternative forms of currency. I'm not a Bitcoin fan, but I just say that maybe there are currency alternatives or other things that could be on the horizon there coming out of innovation law. And B, why not have postal banking, right? I mean, if you have sort of people using, mm-hmm. say, these credit cards or other things, why not have a public option in credit cards or in banking in general, so that people don't have to read through 50 pages of legalese to make sure they're not, they don't have a fee sprung on them randomly, like as described in this wonderful book, called Gotcha Capitalism, about how a lot of fees are just hidden away in the fine print, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh no, I've been hit by this fee. And I think that's a way in which I'm hoping that legal scholars can learn from each other, and can learn from, and we don't just have silos, that we look at problems. And this is a book I cite in my book is called The Flight from Reality and the Human Sciences, and the author, Ian Shapiro, talks a lot about problem-driven research complementing methods-driven research. He says, you know, there are a lot of people that do methods, like say they're an economist, or I'm a historian, or I'm an anthropologist, etc. That's important, but let's also try to complement it with problems that may need the methods of all the social sciences. The analog in law is we have this black box problem, this problem of like very unaccountable secretive companies, but we can't solve it just as, say, consumer protection people or as IP people or as contracts people. We've all got to think together about the problem. And that's what I try to do in this book.
And as we think about those issues, and as you were talking there, Frank, my follow-up, I guess, is this. I mean, you know, there's something about the quality of the information or the qualities of the information that seems relevant here. You know, from the perspective of the harms or risks associated with secrecy, are there any fundamental differences between, let's say, keeping an algorithm secret and keeping a rule for decision making secret? In other words, are they one and the same, or is there something about, you know, the incomprehensibility of technology to the average person, or even not to the average person, as changing the nature of control of information and secrecy?
That is such a great question. And let me back up a bit to explain the implications of that question to listeners who are probably not as immersed in this as you and I.
Yeah, sure, please.
So let's.
That's why you're here.
Let's say that the IRS has a certain rule within the IRS that they have a document that they circulate among people there that say, all right, if a tax return has somebody with giving over 30% of their income to a charitable organization, we're going to audit that because we doubt anybody would give over 30% of their income to a charitable organization, you know. Or it might be we're going to give them, there's a point system. Now, the algorithmic side of this would be maybe there's a point system and that once someone has over 60 points, they get audited, and then that particular action of giving so much to charity would assign to someone, say, 30 points out of the 60 or something like that. Now, in modern times, what you're having is that rather than, say, having that type of thing be secrets, where it's like a rule, a secret rule, or a secret sort of rule of thumb within an agency, you have computer systems that can, say, model thousands of data points about, you know, they could bring in, well, maybe are people in a given area particularly prone to fraud or something like that. And those sorts of systems, when you think about the comparison, there are arguments on each side about whether they should be treated the same or differently than laws, you know. Now, the example that I've just gone over, there's respect for secrecy in both contexts. I mean, we always have respected the right of agencies that say in their law enforcement function not to disclose exactly how they're going after people. And similarly with algorithms, once they bring in an algorithm, perhaps they can keep it under that umbrella of saying, look, we can't tell the bad guys how we're going to look for bad guys, or else they'll all go and hide elsewhere, or do things that have not yet been caught by algorithm. The problem, I think, with a lot of contemporary uses of algorithms, though, is that this is expanding way beyond the penal context and way beyond the law enforcement situation. So, for example, with credit scoring, you know, you might have there might be laws of credit or laws involved that, you know, should be public. But if you have people just using scores, they can sort of point to the scoring system as a trade secret and say, well, we're never going to tell you exactly how we calculated the score that, say, knocked you out of contention for a loan or gave you a really high interest rate. And I think that that worries me because I feel like the secrecy there allows entities to either use bad data or to use things that might end up being discriminatory or that might hurt a certain group of people or even a single person very disproportionately. And I think that when you have that type of system without the – and now, and of course, the people behind the algorithms are going to say, well, if we disclosed it, people would game the system, et cetera. But I think that we need to at least experiment with more public scoring systems. So one of the things I would say back to them is that if you really believe in the scientific method and you really believe in innovation, why not just try having 5% of people being scored by a public scoring system? You know, Jim Manzi has this book called Uncontrolled, which is not exactly this type of experimentalism in public policy and experimentalism among corporations. And that, I think, is the answer to this gaming concern, is to say, well, right now we have this monoculture. And indeed, that monoculture in part contributed to the housing crisis, because if you have everybody in the country using the same types of secret formulas to decide what's going on and who's getting credit and who isn't, you don't have the type of diversity that could lead to robustness against a financial crisis. You have sort of a nationwide collapse when, say, certain, when the algorithm's wrong, when it's the same one used everywhere. So I think that we have to think about the secrecy in law. Now, one last point. I'm sorry to go on about this, but I wanted to come back to loop back around to the idea of secret law being repugnant to the American character. And that's been a position put forward by Christopher Cutts and by some other scholars about, say, the secret memos about Guantanamo Bay or secret memos about, say, torture or other aspects of security policy. And I think there's very difficult issues raised. But I think in the broad range of law, we need to really commit to the idea that secret law is very problematic and that it needs to be exposed. And to the extent that we're outsourcing decisions that used to be made by lawyers to algorithmic systems, we need to have something like the publicity that is required, say, of agency decisions, of judicial decisions, other things like that, to accompany them, because the algorithms are our new laws.
We're chatting with Professor Frank Pasquale, author of the book The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms Behind Money and Information, on KZSFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Frank, so we're coming on, and you know this quite well, the unfair portion of the show, particularly in areas like this. But I'm going to ask a few questions for you and just ask you to, answer the questions within a couple of minutes, although we have about 6 minutes left, 6-7 minutes. So, you're clearly not writing a book saying, let's open up the floodgates, all information out there, right? There are scholars that go in that direction. So you're not in that radical transparency camp, nor are you, of course, one that is generally sympathetic, I mean that in a general sense, right, generally sympathetic to the notion that control of information is a right or something that entities that own information, and even putting the ownership at Tina, is a problem. And so therefore, we're somewhere in the middle. Whenever I teach intellectual property law, and I've said this over and over again, and I'm borrowing, from a line that Eric Goldman has used, where he says, to the extent that anyone says that they know the perfect spot where rights and responsibilities meet for optimal social order in IP, they're lying to you. And I think that that's true, and I've parroted that line. Having said that, though, I recognizing that this is a sector by sector analysis, is there a general sweet spot, or are there parameters that you would call for policymakers to think about that would get you to the sweet spot between radical transparency and the black box? And if so, what would they be?
That is a great question, and I have a few proposals in the book. One of them that I think is underutilized is standardization and data reporting. So we need to make sure that companies are using standard ways of reporting what's going on in them, and I think that would go a long way toward helping with our understanding of the financial sector. When it comes to personal data, like the lists that say are of people who are meth dealers or alcoholics, or lists of people with other diseases or other sensitive information about them, there's now even lists of people that live close to a trailer home park, apparently because a lot of marketers want to exclude them from prime marketing deals because they're seen as customers that won't be maximizing bang for the buck. These types of lists, I think there's a really simple solution, which is that the data brokers need to register, they need to record where they get all their information, and they need to tell people when they put them on sensitive lists that the people care about, and they need to tell a regulator and perhaps also the people affected where they sell this information to. The data brokers now need to, I think the only way we regulate and get a handle on them is they need to say where it's coming from, who's on the list, told one by one. Clearly, if they had to tell the world what the list was, that then would lose all commercial value. But if they tell people one by one, that's not a huge stretch or a huge burden even nowadays, when it's limited to just sensitive lists. And third, knowing where it's being sold on to, so it can be corrected, so you don't have one publisher of, say, a false information about someone suddenly populating literally hundreds of databases with something that's defaming them. And I think as databases get more integrated, that's really important. And finally, in the internet context, I think that we need to have entities set up that can really look under the hood at internet entities. And I can't get into the full technical details here, but there was one person at the FTC who said, we didn't go after Google, but we really kicked the tires on their data. But the problem is they didn't give any rationale or any sense of who exactly was kicking the tires on the data, who was looking at it, what data was given, what the qualifications were of the people who looked at it. That's a problem, I think. And I think that, the better metaphor is looking under the hood rather than just, trying to kick the tires on the car. Have somebody that can actually understand what's going on and have them review it. And we've got to massively ramp up the capacity of regulators or, say, third parties to look at that stuff.
So if the public gets this information, I'm not asking the same questions earlier. I want to ask it this way. So the public gets the information that they need. Let's say, you know, and you spend some time in a book talking about, you know, reputational harm, right? You know, the ability to control one's reputation in an environment where there is this kind of core information being held from the public. You don't know how data brokers are going to profile you. Of course, you don't know what they're going to do with those profiles. And you tell some pretty sickening stories of data brokers who sold lists of consumers, to organizations that then preyed on them through scams and what have you. But if, here's my hypothetical, information's made public and the public reaction is generally ho-hum, right? Or I don't want to say apathy, because apathy implies that they don't care. But let's say the reaction is, okay, right, we can live with that. Are you done? I mean, is that, in other words, does that say, well, all right, information shared, the black box is open, and now society has chosen, right, I'll put that in quotes, chosen this behavior and problem solved? Or is there a deeper root or concern that you have that the information structure to which we're discussing today is merely a symptom?
Oh, no, we're not done at all, because yes. I think that there's a couple of responses to that. And right. One, I would up the ante on apathy. I would say that actually I feel like every time there's a new privacy revelation, and just over the past 2 weeks, there's been bombshell privacy regulations about, mm-hmm. say, the Verizon and AT&T unique code that's put on all these communications within their mobile networks.
Right.
You know, something that sort of is a real shocker to people in the privacy community. My sense is that we may well now have reached the point where every bombshell revelation acts less to sensitize the public to privacy than it does to normalize right. a experience of extensive surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
So given that dynamic, we need to step back and to essentially focus on the use of this information and make sure that the uses are positive and that they are leading to productivity and not to discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
So to give an example of that, I mean, even if, let's say even in a perfect world, we had people all agreeing that they wanted their employer to have access to, say, health records,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, let's say non-HIPAA protected health records. Well, A, we currently have laws that prevent certain uses of those records to go after people that are disabled, to either not hire them or to have adverse action against them. And B, I think we need to strengthen those laws. I think we need to have audits to look at where the data is coming from when, say, employers, insurers, banks, educators, others are making decisions about people, so that it's not being misused and that certain forms of information, even if true, don't even come into the decision-making process, because it just isn't fair. It's not fair to have decisions made on the basis of someone, say, having an illness.
So, Frank, if that's true, and again, these are the pushback kind of questions from an information policy standpoint. All right, so I saw a cartoon today, again, you know, November 4th, showing, you know, showing an audience, right, holding up signs, celebrating, you know, and yelling at the politicians, and they're yelling things like, "We don't want clean water," right? "We don't want you to keep our information from marketers," right? The point being by this cartoon is that voters are now getting, right, or will get what many candidates, not all, said they would do, right? If you are able to deal with information flows in a way that the kinds of secrets that you refer to in the book are less secret in terms of information but become secret in terms of interpretation and understanding, right, what should policymakers do with that? Right? What should policymakers do with this? Because there's a relative ease, is there not, in making information public, right? You hit a button, right? I mean, it's not, you know, here it is. You want it, it's there. That's our entire FOIA system, right? We have a document, we either share with you or we don't. If we don't share it, we keep it. If we do, right, we copy it and send it to you. What should policymakers do if they agree with the notion, right, that more information should be put out there? What would you ask them? What would you advise them? What would you say, and put aside the politics of whether this would actually happen, what would you say that they should do in about a minute and a half?
I think that I'm going to challenge the question a little bit by saying that there's all sorts of different information. And I think that what should guide policymakers as they sequence what becomes open first, because that's the real question, I think. The question is less, you know, there's a giant gauge of like information openness, and we either open it a little bit or more or just open the floodgates. Mm-hmm. I think we have to ask, how much health information do we want to make public? And secondly, who gets this data?
Mm-hmm.
Who gets privileged access to it? How much financial information? How much locational information? Who's getting it? Can they justify why they're getting it and what their uses of the data are? And I think that trying to establish what I call an industrial policy for data, so that, say, we're encouraging uses of data that are really innovative and productive and helping people's health and helping people lead better lives, and we're discouraging the uses that are discriminatory, that's going to be the key to a better economy and a better society.
Frank Pasquale, the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms Behind Money and Information, coming out on November 17, 2014 through Harvard University Press, a really wonderful contribution to our understanding, not just of secrecy, not just of transparency, but really of the entire information culture that we live. Thank you for joining me on the show. You pretty much have a standing invitation. Whenever you have a free moment and I can find an hour, just come on the show. I've gotten to the point where I would almost hand over the show to you for several episodes, but I won't put you on the spot on that one. I'll simply say thank you for joining us today. Thank you for educating my listeners. I look forward to continuing our discussion.
Oh, you're welcome, Dave. Thank you.
So there are a number of guests coming up on the show. Rather than run through those guests, I want to take a moment to note what some of you may have noticed. Again, we're recording this show on November 4, 2014. Hearsay Culture, the website at hearsayculture.com, has been under pretty persistent attack over the last few years from hackers who have been making somewhat successful efforts in turning the Hearsay Culture website into a link farm. The good news is, well, there's two pieces of good news from this. The good news is, as far as I know, there's absolutely no risk from an access standpoint. In other words, you're not going to get viruses by going to Hearsay Culture webpage. And B, through volunteer efforts, I've been able to at least attempt to harness the issue and hopefully resolve it. In the short term, what that's meant is that those of you who go to the Hearsay Culture website will find nothing except an error message. For that, I apologize. I will, though, however, put out a call for anyone that's listening to the show and interested in helping out on these issues. They do come up from time to time, and I'd welcome any volunteers that want to take a look at this issue and help kind of harden the website around these issues, in addition to the wonderful volunteers who are working on it now. You can email me at dave@hearsayculture.com if that's of interest to you, or in fact if you want to learn more. Be that as it may, the show will be airing at 10 a.m. Pacific time Thursdays through this quarter, which runs through the beginning of December 2014. You can get the show then live, and in fact this show will air tomorrow, November 5th, 2014. You can also get the show, and the website I hope will be up and running again within the next day or two, at hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 220 plus previous shows, as well as the list of upcoming guests. You can get the show via podcast by going to cyberlaw.stanford.edu. That's Stanford CIS's webpage, as well as the iTunes engine for the CIS as well. Again, comments, suggestions, feedback, please at dave@hearsayculture.com. Otherwise, thank you for joining us today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.